My next guest on the programme is a man by the name of Peter Allison. And Peter has just produced a book, or has written a book and published it, called Don't Look Behind You, True Tales of a Safari Guide. Peter, it's good to talk to you, and thank you for taking time to talk to us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Not at all. Now, strangely enough, this little brief that I got says that as a child, you knew that you were afraid of heights. And while being uncomfortable about having any phobia, you were glad to have just the one, and then you met your first crocodile. And that kind of changed things for you, did it? Now you had two.
Yeah, and I think they're both fairly reasonable fears. I mean, you hear people afraid of carpet or something like that that's going to paralyze you every day. But unfortunately, I ended up in a job where I was actually dealing with crocodiles every day. It was in Botswana, probably the world's flattest country, so heights didn't play into it, but I do see far more crocodiles than I'd like to.
All right. Now, don't look behind you, obviously, because you never know what you're going to find when you're on safari. But I suppose when you go on safari, you go looking for wild animals, you go looking for danger, don't you?
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, a lot of the things that I think people perceive as dangerous, they're really only dangerous if you treat them in the wrong way. And you start learning your way around the bush just as living in any city you do. And there's little warning signs that you pick up. And in fact, that's actually how we often find it. I'd say 80% of the leopards I see, I find by listening rather than by looking.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm at the point now I feel far safer in the bush than I do in any city in the world. And I'm a city boy originally.
Okay. And what got you started on this whole safari lark?
Labradors. I blame them.
Labradors?
Yep. Labradors. I grew up with Labradors.
Right.
And as unthreatening and often idiotic as they are, I think if you're a little kid and you grow up with Labradors, you're going to end up loving animals.
Okay.
And, yeah, I've just loved animals my whole life. And like many young men out of high school, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was looking at law. I thought if I couldn't be happy, I might as well be rich.
Okay.
But I was going to take a year and backpack around Africa first because of the wildlife in it.
All right.
And that short trip to Africa was 25 years ago, and I'm still here.
And you said you've always liked animals. So when you went to Africa and you started to engage with the animals, there must have been an incredible kind of falling in love with them that you just wanted to stay.
Absolutely. I mean, I arrived, I think, like many people, certainly of a few generations now, growing up with David Attenborough, I started a surrogate grandfather, and I came with this expectation that it was the big predators that were going to enthrall me the most. But almost in no time at all, I realized that elephants, and to this day, elephants for me are the most fascinating animal and the one that I can sit and watch all day, every day,
really?
Quite contentedly for the rest of my life.
Why?
Starters are always doing something. It takes a lot of food to keep an animal that size moving.
Yeah.
And they have a particularly inefficient digestive system, so they're eating up to 250 kilos of food a day.
Whoa.
So they're always moving. They've got rich social and emotional lives, and you can't watch elephants and not learn something new every time. After 25 years, I still see things with elephants that I haven't seen before, whereas lions, conversely, I think of them as the Michael Bublé of wildlife. You know, they're incredibly popular, and I really can't figure out why. Probably just alienated a chunk of your listeners, but it's just...
And what harm, he speaks very highly of you. It does. Okay, that's interesting, because I think everybody likes elephants, but I don't know how comfortable people would be being beside an elephant for the very first time. I don't know how that would be, but interesting what you say about it. So in the book then, you talk about true tales of a safari guide. So are you giving us anecdotes? Are you telling us true stories? Are you talking about your relationship with the different animals?
Yeah, so it's mainly campfire tales, the sort of things which stories that guides tell around the fire after a day of people having their own adventures. And so and obviously after, as I said, 2.5 decades of this, even once you get more experience under your belt, things still happen. I was very well chased by an elephant just 2 weeks ago. In fact, I think it's the furthest I've ever been chased.
Really?
And it was really interesting. There was many, many herds of elephants around, and this one herd, the whole herd, was very, very twitchy.
Okay.
And there was one female within it who just decided to really chase our vehicle. And presumably they've had a very recent bad experience with humans.
Right.
And because while she was chasing, all of the other herds of elephants weren't reacting to our presence at all. They were carrying on with their lives as they would if
she,
we weren't there.
She just had a particular thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So... So that, you know, maybe that will one day make it into another book. If I
and how close,
get a chance to write some more.
How close do you get to the animals when you're on safari?
So if you're on foot, you obviously keep a certain distance, which, again, experience teaches you, even in certain areas. In some places, I'll walk far closer to an elephant than I will in the far north of Botswana, for example. In sort of the middle Botswana, I'll go closer to an elephant than I will on the northern border. And that might sound crazy, but the ones in the northern border walk as far as Angola, and they typically have a bad relationship with humans.
Okay.
Whereas the ones further south live a more peaceful existence. So there's differences in behavior. In a vehicle, it's sometimes insulting how little the animals care about your presence.
Yeah.
And so you can get very close. I've had any number of species, lions, elephants, even a rhino, scratch their itches on a Land Rover, or against a Land Rover, I should say. I've even once had a leopard who was trying so intently stalking that he was looking to walk through the vehicle and over my lap to get to some prey on the other side.
Wow.
I have to just give him a gentle audio reminder. There was a bunch of humans watching. And so he went under us instead.
And these animals, would they be used to seeing regular safaris? Would they be used to seeing humans? The point I'm making is, where they are there specific areas where safaris would be held and where they would pass through? And would these animals be aware? Or do they just roam everywhere and anywhere and occasionally come across humans?
Most of... Certainly of the carnivores, all of the carnivores are territorial. And in areas where there's a lot of food, those territories are typically quite small.
Okay.
And that's a lioness will keep a lion or a group of lions will keep a territory only as big as they need to look after themselves and their babies. Whereas a male lion is, I'm going to have a territory as big as I possibly can because that gives me more girlfriends.
Right, yeah.
But in these areas, mainly the Okavango Delta, we have huge chunks of land which we have private access to. And one which I work in a lot is about 500,000 acres. It's more than three times the size of Singapore.
Right.
And so you can spend days there and not see other people. And those animals, they're familiar with us. We know the patterns of movement of the local leopards, the cheetahs, the African wild dogs, the lions. And they don't roam far from that region. And every now and then you do encounter an animal that you can see it's had little or no interactions with humans, and they run away. Okay. Like you would if you'd never seen a big, growling, smelly four-wheel drive before.
Mm-hmm.
You'd back off, and it's only if it doesn't chase you. Next time, maybe you wouldn't run so far. And we have a long, long process to get the animals relaxed. And sometimes we're generations into this. There's a pride of lions that I've known on and off for over 20 years now. And I saw them go from a struggling, homeless pride of two lionesses and their daughters to, at the current point, I think there's 32 in the tribe.
Wow.
The most dominant on an island in an oasis in the Kalahari Desert.
That's fascinating. And you get to see, because you work in the same area all the time, and you, as you say, there are prides that, you know, that particular pride, you'd have seen changes over the years, you'd have seen changes in short periods of time, in fact, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. In fact, one of those lionesses I just mentioned, she had an affair, let's say, with the wrong males, which led to a clash between male lions, which led to... This ultimately affected the lives of thousands of animals. It's a too long a story to go into now.
Right, right.
It was quite extraordinary being able to witness this, where it caused the rise of hyenas, who became the dominant predators, which drove out all the cheetahs and meant no leopards could raise young, while dogs also left the area. And this whole long thing of which lasted a few years, and that was far better than any soap opera I've ever seen. It was very Game of Thrones, but less porn.
By being so close to animals on a wild animals on a regular basis, do you see similarities between how they behave and how we humans behave?
Yes, and the more you learn about animals, and the more you see these behaviours. I remember I'd actually been living in the bush for a few years, and I hadn't been back to Australia for quite some time. And I went into a pub there, and I was just watching the interactions and transactions of humans. And I thought, oh, I'm on safari. I know exactly what that guy is doing. And she's a wildebeest. And that guy there is undoubtedly a baboon.
Right.
And there's the preening, there's a wonderful thing called displacement activity,
right.
Which you see quite often. You see it often with the prey species, like an impala. If you stop your vehicle beside them, they get a little bit nervous, because normally the only time a vehicle stops is because there's a lion or a leopard.
Okay.
And so the impalas, they get a little adrenaline dump, but they don't want to just go running blindly, but you'll see them picking up their leg, putting it back down. They're grooming a little bit vigorously, okay. Licking their lips a lot.
Yeah.
Now, in humans, of course, that's we touch our hair, we touch our face, we can draw our lips in and out. And seeing all this displacement, it's like, that person's nervous, this person's or excited. And it's really, really fascinating
to
see how much of this animal behavior we still carry.
And the instincts that the animals have, and if all you've got to do is watch an Attenborough program, and you can see the instinct that they have. I once heard that we, as children or babies, when we're born, we have the same instincts. We can smell our mothers. We can, you know, we can sense things that, and we lose that. Why is that? Do you know? I know you're not a human expert, but is it very obvious when you're dealing with animals all the time, the deficit that's on the human side?
Yeah, I would think certainly a lot of our senses aren't as sharp because we've evolved different characteristics.
Mm.
So we all know that dogs can hear at higher pitches than we can.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for some reason, that doesn't seem so strange, but the idea that certain birds can see more color than we can is really hard to get your head around. And we can't, so a falcon or a kestrel, for example, can see ultraviolet light,
which
seems extraordinary to us, but that's because the droppings of their prey and the urine of their prey fluoresces, so they can actually see the highways used by the little voles and moles and rodents that they hunt, which is so they know exactly where to hover or where to hunt. They're not wasting time over away from the highways.
Right.
So we don't need that. We don't have it. And similarly, I think a lot of these instincts, all of these things are expensive. Anything that you're expending energy on but is not necessary gets shed by evolution pretty quickly. So we obviously didn't need a tail, so that's long gone. It's a pity. I think it'd be quite nice to have one. So there's any number of things that we've shed to make way for the life that
the lifestyle that we
in
have
Africa before spreading out.
Okay.
Yeah, and we are born with a fear of snakes and spiders. And is that really innate? Yeah, that's been proven.
I'm not afraid of spiders. Snakes, I haven't encountered that much of. I'd give them the respect they deserve. I think if I was to come, I came across one recently here in Spain, but at a distance. Yeah, I didn't know that we were born with that.
Yeah, and they're chimps as well, and obviously they're. One of our nearest relatives, along with bonobos, and they've done experiments where they've shown human babies, and there's a flinch response which they don't have to other dangerous things. So we're not born with a fear of sharks; we learn it, and somehow I developed a fear of crocodiles.
I don't think
not alligators, weirdly.
Really? Yeah.
Not alligators, but crocodiles. Yes.
What's the difference? What is the difference between an alligator and a crocodile?
There's a number of internal ones.
Okay.
The one of the more common ones you can see is that crocodiles have in their lower jaw the fourth tooth sticks out a bit more and doesn't have a socket.
Oh, okay.
So crocodiles, when their mouth is shut, look much toothier, whereas alligators look a bit gummier.
Okay.
Alligators can also withstand far greater cold than crocodiles, and they're typically better mothers. When I say better mothers, by our standards, the American alligator will look after her babies for as long as 2 years, which is actually the record for any reptile.
Right, okay. Now, this book is called Don't Look Behind You, and you say True Tales of a Safari Guide. Are they all true?
They are.
Really?
Yeah, I've changed a few names in there
because
I'm a bit disparaging about colleagues and occasionally clients, and certainly myself. I mean, I've spent far more time in trees as an adult than I ever did as a boy.
Really?
The story of what happens when you make an idiot a safari guide. How not to be a safari guide manual.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, we look forward to reading the tales of the safari guide. Don't Look Behind You, it's called. It's available on Amazon and in good bookstores. It's coming out. Oh, it's out today, isn't it? Is it being released today?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, it is. All right, and we'll have it available, I'm sure, at the TRE bookstore at TRE.radio as well. Peter, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks very much. By the way, how's the dog?
The dog is fantastic. He's been very well behaved. He's sitting. He's a 60 kilogram. So, if he did bark, all of Spain would have heard it.
Yeah, because Wendy mentioned to me, you'll be talking, she said, to Peter Allison at 5:30, and maybe his dog. And I said, okay, well, that's fair enough. I believe you got rid of the children, so you wouldn't have noise in the background. But the dog had to stay.
They're driving around somewhere.
Well, listen, give them a shout and tell them they can go home now. It's all safe. I thank you so much for talking to me today and wish you well with the book.
All right.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much indeed. Peter Allison, author, Don't Look Behind You, True Tales of a Safari Guide.